So our keynote speaker this morning is the Chief Open Source Officer at Sun Microsystems. He coordinates Sun's extensive participation in free and open source software communities, including sunsource.net. He currently chairs the Open Solaris Community Advisory Board and is active in several open source organizations. Please welcome Simon Phipps.
Oh, it does work now. Good morning. So I was first away from the table last night down at the Olympic Pier, and that was at midnight. So I know that there are people here nursing short nights, shall we say, gently. So good morning, everybody. You've heard my name. I have this curious job title up here. Going into the new year at Sun, I have the glorious responsibility of steering Sun's open source strategy in the year when we're actually going to get round to open sourcing Java SE. And that's kind of scary. So what I thought I would do for you this morning is try and explain to you how I see open source. And then, as long as I speak really fast, towards the end, there should be room for a Q&A, in which I believe Kirk is going to pepper me with difficult questions, like he did over wine last night. Before I go too much further, I should tell you a bit of my history. I joined Sun 6 years ago, and when I joined Sun, I came from IBM. At IBM, the thing I had done most recently was help introduce XML into the company. If you can introduce XML into the company that first of all fathered the idea of markup languages in the 60s. Before that, I helped start IBM's Java marketing organization. Before that, I was part of the team that introduced the Java platform into IBM in 1995 in Hursley Park. Before that, I worked on video conferencing. And it was the killing of the video conferencing project that meant that I, along with the rest of the team, were sitting around wondering what to do in Hursley when the opportunity to evaluate Java came up. And before that, well, I had a software company in the late 80s that did very well until some big monopolist put us out of business. And before that, I worked for Unisys, and before that, I worked for Burroughs, and before that, I did assembler on 6800 microprocessor development systems, and before that, I was 14. So, let's tell you a story. As I say, when I was working for IBM in at the beginning of the 90s, and this was also at Hursley Park, I worked on X25 networking for a while. And in 1991, I moved on to a team that was developing a great piece of video conferencing software. Now, just out of interest, you all look a bit young for this, but how many people here used to run OS2 back in the day? Anyone give me a wave? Oh, there's a few of you around. Maybe you'll remember Person to Person, which was an asymmetric networked video conferencing system with collaborative software. Still really no peer in the industry. Apple is gradually getting there with iChat, but they've got a way to go yet. And as you can imagine, when you're working on video conferencing, one of the things you have to do is you have to fly all over the world to tell people about it. So I did that a lot in 1991. And when I went on a trip in 1991, I used to find myself having to get a big bundle of money off IBM before I left. They'd give me a huge envelope full of all the currencies I was going to need and the traveler's checks. And I immediately became one of the most muggable people in the area when I left with this big wad of money. They would give me a huge book of airline tickets. Every segment that I flew had a thick card paper ticket, interestingly enough, in the format of an IBM punch card. It's amazing how the decisions you take live with you for decades afterwards for the most trivial reasons. And do remember that as you're designing data structures. Once I was traveling to stay in touch, I would use telephone kiosks and telephone bureau. You remember telephone bureau at airports, the wooden boxes that you'd go into, and you'd give the receptionist a telephone number, which she would then misdial several times, and you'd try and stay in touch with your family. The most exciting part was getting mail from home. And, of course, in those days, the way you got mail from home was your family presciently wrote down the latest news about 8 weeks in advance and sent them post-restant to the city that you were going to. So now, fast forward 15 years, and I'm still traveling for a living. I'm one of the 21st century's gypsies. And in 2006, when I travel, well, the same categories are covered. How are they covered? Well, take cash and traveler's checks, for example. I don't actually bother carrying cash anymore when I go to a new country. What I do is I arrive at the airport and I carry an international identity card. I don't know if you have one of these. It says Visa on the top. And what I do is I get my international identity card and I assert my identity to a local bank and they give me cash. It's worked everywhere I've been in the last 3 or 4 years. It worked in Beijing, worked in Harare, it's worked down in Brazil. It even worked here in Spain yesterday. And consequently, I don't actually carry cash and traveler's checks anymore. Airline tickets are a thing of the past. I haven't had a paper airline ticket for quite a while. The only time it comes up is where I plan an itinerary that carelessly crosses across between Star Alliance and Oneworld, in which case they insist that I pay extra for a paper ticket. I don't use telephone kiosks or telephone bureau anymore. In fact, I don't even use calling cards anymore. I just carry a GSM mobile phone, and it works everywhere that I travel. And, well, then there's post-restant. Way in the past, email is now completely ubiquitous. It's got to the point now where my children don't write home from college anymore. What they do is they say, Dad, well, you know, we don't write letters anymore. We send email. So I wait for the email. That doesn't come either. But, you know, it's the thought that counts. So what's changed in the 15 years between these two things? Well, what's changed is the introduction of ubiquitous networking. We have entered a participation age. And networking has entered the lifeblood of society. And it's changed the way that things work. It's changed the way that things happen. And it's changed them as profoundly as the 20th century philosophers changed the way that we looked at the world and the way that we did architecture. It's changed the world as profoundly as communism did at the beginning of the 20th century. It has actually produced a tangible change in the way that we go about our lives every day. And the reason I've given you these examples is no one would consider, or no one that I know would consider any of these four categories as geeky. Life has changed because of ATM cards. I remember at Hursley we used to line up on a Friday at the bank inside the offices and get the money out for the weekend so we could go and eat and drink on Saturday and Sunday. And you'd actually spend an hour or more in a line in the bank on a Friday lunchtime. And there's no need to do that anymore. I just take it for granted that I'm going to find an ATM somewhere and get money out. Life tangibly changes in the way that you interact with people, the way that you handle money, the way that you conduct your life, the way that you talk to people. And that's all happened because of the introduction of networking. And that 15 years is a remarkably short span of time. Think about how long it takes for a philosophy normally to change the world. You know the way that philosophies change the world. Some crazy guy has an idea and calls it a philosophy. And then some professor writes a book about it and starts teaching students about it. And the students gradually graduate. Then they get a job in government. Then they make laws that are based on the crazy idea. Then people live in the society under those laws and have children. And the children grow up believing the crazy idea is a basic presupposition of everyday life. Duty cycle for that is around about 75 to 90 years. This happened in 15 years. Absolutely remarkable. So that's brought about a fundamental change, and I believe that the consumer age is history because of this. It's one of these things that's becoming true. But the consumer age, the age in which a vendor could tell you that you can have any color you like as long as it's black, well, you know, I think that's over. I think that we're leaving the consumer age, and we're moving into a participation age, an age where networking is in the lifeblood of society. And everything changes as a consequence. Now, if you want to read more about this change that's happening, I really recommend a book by an academic called Yochai Benkler. Benkler wrote a paper at the beginning of the decade called Coase's Penguin, which looked at the work of Ronald Coase, who was a very influential economist. He wrote a paper called The Nature of the Firm. And I'll give you a quick summary of his outlook. Coase asserted that it was easier for skilled individuals to make money in a firm or in a company than it was in a free market in the consumer age. And the reason for that is because when you join a firm, you're able to network with your colleagues. And you build up a know-how and a skill over and above what you're actually selling. And your company is then able to effectively to charge for the right to use that know-how. And is able to put up a gate at the front of the company, which people have to pay to go through. And what Benkler asserted in Coase's Penguin is that, well, what's happened is networking has come into society, and now everyone has got the ability to network with everyone else casually. And now, today, the firm no longer has an inherent advantage. And that is bringing a shift, not just in the way that technology works, but also in the way that business is able to monetize its investments. And that thinking is what lies right at the heart of what I do at Sun. It is the thinking that we are on the cusp of a change in the way that business is able to be productive and to monetize its work. And I'm trying to understand, well, what does that change mean in terms of how we develop software and how we make the money that pays for the software development? So in amongst all this change, well, all sorts of geeky stuff changes as well. And we see new movements springing up the whole time, new programming languages. And some of them are quite groovy. You see viruses coming around. You see spam. You see a shift towards digital identity, a shift towards smart cards. You see the Java platform maturing and becoming the basis for business for those people who prefer to select their own architectures. You see new models of business like subscription models coming along. All of these things flow from the same root, which is the insertion of networking into society and the ability of people outside a formal firm to be able to casually align with each other. And to give you some examples of things that change, think about security. In the old world, security was about boundaries. It was about things that were separate from each other and the pipes between them. And you did security by protecting the boundaries. Well, in the new age, the boundaries aren't any use as demarcation lines because there isn't a there and a here anymore. There's just a network. And what matters much more in the network is to ask, who are you? And in this place, what may you do? And security shifts from the enforcement of boundaries to the management of digital identity. That's a shift that flows out of the network age. Software changes. Software changes from stuff that runs on isolated systems and gradually shifts into becoming small pieces loosely joined. That's something that flows out of the networked era. Software pricing. Software pricing was always based on the fact that you had things that ran on boxes that were well isolated and distinguished. And you could price things based on the ephemera of those boxes. You could count how many boxes there were or count how many CPUs there were. But that doesn't work anymore because who cares about the details? Who cares how many CPUs you've got in your data center? Who cares how many cores there are in the processor? It matters as much as how many light bulbs there are in these chandeliers. Who cares, as long as they light the room up when you turn the switch? And consequently, software pricing is moving away from counting ephemera and moving towards value-based pricing. It's moving towards charging for what the software actually delivers. So moving towards subscription models, to service models, to models that are not based on gating the right to use. Customer engagement changes. In the old consumer society, you could find yourself sitting in a place listening to some elderly guy dressed in black telling you what you ought to think. But that doesn't happen anymore. What happens these days is that there is a conversation, a dialogue, and messaging and marketing moves over to a world of conversation. Conversation is going on within the marketplace all the time. This was the reason why 2 years ago I started blogs.sun.com. It's because I don't believe that having carefully crafted marketing and PR messages helps a company very much anymore. I think that what matters far more is that you put technology into the hands of the people who want to use it. And I'm going to come back to that thought. And then software development. The way you used to develop software in the world of islands, in the world of isolated things, was you would hire all the smart people and you would lock them in a room And you'd slide pizza under the door until they had written whatever it was that you wanted written. And then you could charge admission to the room. Great model for software development. Many people got very rich on it. Some of them have decided that they're going to retire around about now because they're so rich. Well, that closed room model, I believe, has gone away. Because you see, actually, you can't hire all the smart people. And that never used to matter in the world of islands, in the world of distinct systems. Because, well, you know, you could hire what you thought was all the smart people, and I could hire what I thought was all the smart people, and we could be very happy producing systems in isolation from each other. But today, statistically, I can't hire any of the smart people. The smart people are all still out in the marketplace. And you know what? They're all on a mailing list. And you know what? They're all working on the same software that I want written. Only because I'm stuck with using a few people in a closed room, I just get the benefit of the wisdom of the 3 or 4 people I've been able to hire, and I'm cut off from the wisdom of the 300 or 400 people who are out on the mailing list. And so the people on the mailing list gradually, inexorably, produce better software than I can make. And if I want to produce good software in the future, in the world of the networked economy, it's far smarter for me to join in with the networked conversation and build my software based on that networked conversation. And that is the open source model. And this is not the way that everyone develops software today. But I believe that there is no reason whatever why one should not do collaborative software development in communities for every category of software development. There are so few categories of software where you are the only person interested in that category. Everyone is adding value onto a body of know-how that is well explored. And you are far better off adding value to somebody else's commodity than you are in developing the commodity as well as adding the value add. So that's open source. And I believe that open source is a huge change in the way that software is developed, but it's a huge change that we've done before. To give you open source in a nutshell, open source is the work of a community of software developers. And that community of software developers are gathered around a body of code that they all share in common with each other. And that body of code forms the heart of the community. They all have equal access to it. They're all able to derive wealth from that commons. And this is using the word in the way that Paul Graham uses it in Hackers and Painters. Everyone is able to develop something which is of value to them. It may be of value to them because it makes them money. It may be of value to them because it achieves their personal goals. It may be of value to them because it helps somebody else that is of value to them. But whatever it is, people gathered around the code commons use that commons to create wealth. And then, in the process of doing that, they enrich the commons and, by so doing, benefit everyone in the cycle. What is this? Is this model communism? Is this model a cancer on society? As, again, someone once said. I suggest to you this is the craft guilds rediscovered, and rediscovered about 200 years before they became a cancer on society. This is not communism. This is connected capitalism. This is what happens when the self-interest of many individuals and groups begin to casually align because the network is in society and allows them to meet each other. That is what open source is. Open source is not getting stuff for free. Open source is the casual alignment of self-interest such that the network effect can allow everybody to gain value from each other's work. That's what open source is about. To illustrate that, I've got some of the finest graphic artists in the world to help draw me a picture here. So here we go. This is a software developer, as you can tell. Now, she's developed some software or other. I don't know what it is that she's developed. It's maybe some kind of a database system. I don't know. And she's very proud of that software. And she's decided she is going to publish the source code for that software for everyone to see. So she does that. She creates a source code commons. And she obviously derives the software that makes her living from that source code commons and goes about her business. She is a little disadvantaged by doing that because she has to actually put comments in the code and she has to sometimes explain her design decisions in public. But fundamentally, it hasn't made life a whole lot more difficult for her. After a while, some guy comes along over here and he decides that he likes this software as well, that he could very easily create something that makes wealth for him out of it. We have the pizza wheel of death. So teach me to run beta software in a presentation. So some guy comes along, starts using that software. Now, he makes his own wealth-generating software out of it. He creates something that is of value to him. And he maybe adds a few features. Now, it could stop there. He could decide that he is going to create this software and maintain it separately from her. But if he does that, he is going to become responsible not just for his innovation, but also for all her code. Every time she fixes a bug, in order to get the same bug fixed, he's going to have to re-implement it and regression test all of the value he's added. Whenever he adds value, he is going to have to maintain all the code that he has added on top of the commons. And he quickly realized this is a stupid idea. And so he takes the innovation he is adding on top of her work and he contributes it back into the source commons. He does this not out of a sense of philanthropy, not out of a desire to be put out of business, not because free stuff is good, but because it makes sound economic sense to share your innovations with the rest of the commons, because then they'll maintain it for you. They'll regression test it for you. They'll make sure that it stays up to date with new versions. They'll make sure that it keeps pace with the innovation of the rest of the community. And so that happens around the commons. Other people come along and start using that code. It's slide 13, that's what's done it. Other people come along and start using the code. You get some people who come along, they're just tire kickers. They just want to look at the source code and see what it does. They don't do any harm. You get other people who decide that they are going to take the code and re-implement it themselves and live with their implementation for all eternity. Well, they don't do the community any harm. They only do themselves harm if they decide that they are then going to maintain the whole body of code. Forks don't fundamentally cause harm to the community that has the code forked out of it. They do dilute the pool of interest that's maintaining the code, but more than anything else, they harm the people who are creating the forks, because those people then have to develop the same skills as the rest of the ecosystem put together. And as I talk to friends from Apache, they continually assert to me that everyone gives back in the end. That the people who don't give back go out of business. And the people who give back, in the end, everyone gives back and profits from the value of the system. To move on from here, we're going to have to kill this, I think. What do you think? Should we kill it? Let's kill it. So betting it won't shut down either. So that is the open source model. It is a model of a community of people who are able to synchronize their self-interests with each other and are able to produce increased value by doing so. It's a model where people join not out of a sense of philanthropy or altruism, but out of their self-interest, but casually synchronized with the self-interest of others. And so as you look at that model, you begin to realize that there is a cycle going on. And that cycle is controlled at three points by different aspects of the open source movement. Those three control points that exist are, first of all, there has to be some control over how the software gets out of the commons and into the hands of the developers. So the control over how the software gets out of the commons and into the hands of the developers is the license. And a while back, most geeks decided that they neither trusted corporations nor wanted to hire a lawyer. And as a consequence, they stopped wanting to click through in a 10-page end-user license agreements. They stopped wanting to have to parse and analyze new license agreements for advanced technologies. And they decided that they would like to select their licenses the way that, certainly in the past, Catholics select reading books. The way Catholics select reading books is they open the cover and they look and they see whether the bishop's seal is on the book to say that it is sound doctrine. And good Catholics then know that that book is worth reading. Bad Catholics know to pick up another book. And that's the same method that applies in the open source community. A bishop somewhere, someone like Eric Raymond, looks at the license and works out whether it is safe for somebody who is an independent developer to use software under that license. And if it is, they put their imprimatur on the license, they approve it, and it joins a list of approved licenses. The shift in licensing practice is a shift away from custom licensing and a shift towards pre-approved licensing. Now, that causes heartache for quite a few corporations, the reason being that, you write custom licenses to create a partnership space with a potential business or partner. And if you can't write your own license, you can't create a custom partnership space. But fortunately, that doesn't matter very much anymore, because the place where you monetize your software and your investment in technology is gradually shifting away from the point of code selection, from the point of procurement, and moving towards the point of software deployment, the point where value is derived. And consequently, the licensing space for the right to use is becoming less and less important for monetization. We'll come back to that in a minute. The second point of control is on the other side of the loop, where you have to ask yourself the question, how does code get in the commons in the first place? And code gets in the commons as the result of the rules of the community. And I call the system of rules that govern a community its governance. They answer questions like, who gets to commit changes to the version control system? Under what circumstances? How does someone get those privileges to commit changes back to the version control system? Who gets to vote when there is a dispute? Who gets to decide who is part of the community and who is not part of the community? Those are all governance questions. And actually, those questions are all far more interesting when it comes to the protection of your freedoms than the license is. The license is kind of a hygiene factor. It either lets you use the commons or it doesn't let you use the commons. But the governance is much more subtle, because the governance gets to say whether you get to play or not. So you can probably think of examples of open source communities where all of the committers work for the same company. Well, what governance is at work there? How would you get to be one of those committers? Would you have to get a job at the company that employs them all? What happens to your commit privilege if you leave that company? Does it get just terminated at the snap of fingers? Those are really interesting questions. Because it's those questions that decide whether you're going to be able to have a service-level agreement with a customer. If your business is shifting away from the right to use and is moving towards the ability to monetize at the point of deployment, at the point of deployment, what you typically monetize is service of production systems. And if you do that, well, there'll be a service-level agreement. And in the service level agreement, it will say how fast you have to fix bugs, and it will say whether or not those bug fixes have to be part of the next release. And to make those commitments, you've got to have certain rights in the community. If you don't have those rights in the community, trust me, no one with any sense is going to pay for your service level agreement. So actually what matters to us in the world of open source software development is not so much the license. Yes, that's very important, and the shift towards pre-approved licensing is a key shift. But what matters to us is, assuming we're able to demonstrate adequate skill, are we able to get commit privileges? Are we able to influence the direction of the community? And most importantly, do we have the tools with which we are able to make business commitments to our customers? Those are the really important questions if you're looking at an open source community. And then finally, the final point that I look at on the cycle of open source is to ask, how diverse is the community? An open source community, which is a monoculture, is just as bad as any other kind of monoculture. If you read my blog, you'll see that I'm harsh and mean-spirited towards monocultures, in particular monocultures based on a particular operating system. And the reason for that is because I believe that monocultures lead you into harmful situations. Okay, well, and not being a woman, I have to stop talking when I'm operating my computer. Oh, screen goes blank. Okay, I'm going to pull, just take a breath. I'm going to. Just to give you a background of what I'm using here, I'm using a piece of interesting software called NeoOffice. Give me some waves here. How many people are using a Linux desktop for their software development? Give me a wave. Thank you. How many people are deploying on Linux? Okay, how many people use Macs? Yeah, congratulations. So I assume the rest of you are still with the dark side, yeah? Okay. Yes, I really want to continue. So what I'm using here is I'm using a piece of software called NeoOffice. NeoOffice is a fork of OpenOffice.org. OpenOffice.org, as you know, is the desktop productivity suite that was derived out of StarOffice. And no, we don't want to recover that. Thank you. Yes, I'm certain I want to. Thank you. Now, the OpenOffice.org folks didn't want to make a version for the Mac. And so a couple of guys decided they were going to make a port to the Mac. This is with the Mac user interface. There has been a port, an X11 port to the Mac for quite some time. But some guys got hold of that port, and they have put a Java front end on it. And actually, NeoOffice is a Java application that is front-ending a large lump of C, C++, and assembler, which is the engine that lies behind the presentation tool and the word processor. And this is a fantastic example of why forks are not always bad. This is a live fork. OpenOffice.org is still in progress over here. NeoOffice is over here deriving a product from OpenOffice.org. They're not making any putbacks for reasons that I can tell you later. They are opening up a new market. They have to remain compatible because their business depends on people being able to move documents backwards and forwards between OpenOffice.org and NeoOffice. So they have a fork, but a fork does not mean incompatibility. And I've written about that on my blog fairly recently as well. Okay, so where did we get to? We got down to about here. Okay. So I'm not going to tell you about this, but I will just tell you that I've done some work trying to understand open source licensing, and I've written a white paper that categorizes open source licenses into the categories that Sun uses to decide how it's going to license projects. And rather than having to wade through, I think it's there are now 58 open source licenses, rather than having to wade through all of them, what I do with new projects that are going open source is I ask them which license class they are going to use. And then we identify the license once the license class is identified. And I look at those license classes, and they tend to have common attributes. If you'd like to read more about this, the white paper is on sun.com/open source. You'll see it over in the right-hand column, one down at the moment. And I welcome your comments. I intend to revise that sometime in the fourth quarter this year. The watchword for licensing, though, in my view, is the most freedom for the most people. And, of course, that's for select values of freedom. Now, do you ever worry that you're using technology that has been patented? Does anyone ever worry about that? Give me a wave. Who here cares? There we go. And does anyone here think it's worth paying extra to get a piece of software which is indemnified against patent action? Fascinating. Must make sure I tell a few people that. So I actually personally believe software patents are one of the great threats to our industry. The reason why I believe that is because software patents emerge from nowhere. You have no idea when you are using a software patent. I guarantee you that you are violating software patents that are held in the computer industry every single day you work. And the only thing that makes that not a problem is, well, the majority of them aren't enforceable in the countries where you live, so that's great. And secondly, you're probably not worth suing. But actually, if you then join and affiliate with a community of other people working on a code on a base of software, you might become worth suing. Not because someone wants money from you, but because people want to put fear, uncertainty, and doubt into that community and disable it and stop it being a competitive threat. And so I spent a lot of time last year campaigning against the Software Patent Directive in Europe, and I worked with Mark Webbink from Red Hat, and we managed to kill the thing off last year. But like the undead, it's constantly pushing the lid of the coffin up and coming back again. I hear that the zombie has been seen in Brussels again, so I think I'm going back there. The thing about software patents is that they happen. They have to happen all the time. Sun has them. Red Hat has them. IBM has them in truckloads. And the reason for this is because in the US, you have to compete with other corporations who've got them. And it becomes just like the gun control problem in the US as well. Everyone carries a gun because everyone carries a gun. And everyone files software patents because everyone files software patents. An American corporation has to have a portfolio of them to trade in order to, I don't know if you've read Kipling, but in order to pay the Danegeld, in order to make sure that when someone turns up at the door demanding money, you've got something to fight them off with. And so the nature of US law means that everyone is filing patents. And the way that it happens is not that people look at the end of the process for innovation and patent it. The way that it works is that corporate employees are constantly incented to file patents day in and day out in parallel with their software development activity and independently of the purpose to which it's going to be applied. And that means that at most big corporations, the people working on open source are filing patents as well. And it's happening. It just happens as part of the system. Guarantee it happens. So everyone has got to deal with these things in time, and the more that the World Trade Organization and WIPO inflict US law on the rest of us in the world, we're going to have to deal with these things more and more. So I believe it's very important that we build patent commons as we're building the software commons that goes with it. And there's three approaches to doing that. One of them is specific patent grants. And that's the idea behind things like IBM's patent grant and the patent commons that the OSDL is working on. The second is compulsory licensing. And that's the idea that lies behind software licenses like CDDL and the Mozilla Public License that contain within them the requirement that all participants compulsorily license their patents to people working on code that uses them. And then the third approach is non-assert covenants. So this is something that Sun did has done a couple of times now. We did it with SAML just a few days ago, where we say, look, see this category here, you know, this standard, for example, we guarantee you we'll never enforce software patents on people who are working in this area. And so then you can work in that area with the assurance that you're never going to get a patent attack from the biggest players in that space. It doesn't protect you against patent trolls. That's companies that exist solely to make your life miserable and themselves richer. But it does protect you against attack by the people who are most likely to hold the patents on your work, which is your colleagues. All three of these are essential, and I advise you as you join open source communities and as you work on standards bodies to make sure that you're working with people who understand that this is a problem and are taking all three of these approaches towards solving them. No one of these approaches solves the problem. So I've been talking all about the mechanics of open source up until now, but open source is a little bit like going flying. You see here a gentleman with his son. They're going flying. They're going to go and see grandma. And to them, flying means finding the right gate. It means hoping there's no delay, that grandma will be there at the airport when they arrive. It means deciding which airline to fly with, hoping it has a waiting lounge where the smoking isn't allowed. Out the other side of the glass, there's a pilot on the plane. To him, flying means filing an itinerary, following the safety procedures, understanding the language that's used at the airport that he's arrived at. It involves the technical details of the plane and working together with the co-pilots. To both of them, it's flying, but what flying means depends on your context. And it's just the same with open source. And open source is about collaboration between individuals. So why on earth would anyone use open source in production? What's interesting about open source in production? Well, I believe that we're moving towards software market 3.0. I don't believe O'Reilly has trademarked this yet, so I'll carry on talking about it. Software market 3.0 is a wave that is just coming about now. Market 1.0 was where the software came with the box. That was where we were when I joined the computer industry. Software market 2.0 happened at what was called the great unbundling back at the beginning of the 80s, where you no longer got the software with the box. You had to buy the software separately from the box. And the software was monetized not at the point of hardware selection, but at a separate point of selection in parallel with the hardware selection. In software market 3.0, though, the way that you work is you build with the software that you have to hand. And you use whatever frameworks and libraries and tools seem best to you to use. And then when you go into production, you buy the licenses or the service contracts that are necessary for you to go into production. And I believe that that world of monetization at the point of value is the place that the software industry is heading towards. I believe we're moving away from paying for software in advance. I don't believe that developers will, for very much longer, continue to use what they've paid for. I believe that in the future, what will happen is that people will pay for what they use, and that will characterize software markets. And that's the world I'm preparing Sun for. There's no point me preparing Sun for a world where people pay for the right to use NetBeans, because no one is going to pay for the right to use NetBeans. It's a great piece of software, not deriding it in any way, but, well, you know, just as we've seen Borland go out of business, anyone else that thinks they're going to make money out of the right to use had better make sure they've got their pension plan up to date. So people deploying software are going to become much more discerning. What you used to deploy was a black box of software values. That black box of software values contained within it the binary. It contained the documentation in some cases, often as much as two pages. It contained a piece of paper with an indemnity statement on it. It contained a phone number to call for help. It contained a whole set of values that you might need to go into production. But the truth is that not everyone needs that set of values anymore. And so what will increasingly be offered is subsets, packages of value elements that are necessary for different classes of industry to go into production. And open source business models will revolve around identifying markets that you wish to service and identifying bundles of values that those markets need to go into production, and then selling those bundles of values. Now, not everybody will need everything. There will be some people who get what you are wanting to sell for free in some way. Maybe they'll have someone on staff who can do it. Maybe they don't care about indemnity, just as no one in this room cares about indemnity. There are plenty of people who do care about indemnity and are willing to pay big money to be indemnified against predatory companies. And this leads people to look at open source software and say, well, how can you make money if it's all free? Well, everything is free to someone, and nothing is free to everyone. And the art of business in the world of open source is understanding who will pay for what and delivering it in a way that they think it's worth paying for. And that's a much harder art than charging 99% markups on the right to use software that's enforced by the BSA. But it's the place that we're moving to. And I hope that we're going to be ready. I know that our competitors are hoping that they're going to be ready too. Just some brief comments on freedom. Open source software is said to be based on freedom as opposed to free. And so I asked the question, does open source software set you free? Does it keep your costs down? And open source software does indeed set you free in many ways. In just the same way as these scuba divers here are free, they can swim wherever they want to in the ocean. They can dive into the sea just down at the coast, down at the Olympic port, and they could swim all the way to the US if they wanted to, as long as they are never more than about 10 minutes from some ship that can fill those white bottles up. See, they are free, but they have a technical dependency. And just because you're using open source software, it doesn't mean that you are free of technical dependencies. And being the master of those technical dependencies in a cost-effective way is the key to freedom. Open source in and of itself does not ensure that you are free. What actually makes you much more free is being able to sit with your vendor or with your consultant supplier or whoever you're paying money to and tell them that you're willing to leave the room because their price is wrong. And what gives you the freedom to leave the room because the price is wrong is substitutability. The ability to take your code and at a cost less than what's being asked you in the room negotiating for the contract, migrate to something else. And that mostly comes about through standards. So does that mean that standards are the key to freedom? Whoop, boom. Are standards the key to freedom? Well, up to a point. But imagine that you are going to go and buy a new lawnmower. Summer is here. The grass is growing outside in the garden. There could be tigers out there, for all you know. So you decide you need a new lawnmower. So you decide that you're going to go for a standard lawnmower to keep your costs down. You go for the ISO 36048 standard in lawnmowers. And so you go down to the store, and you know that they're eco-friendly. They're built from sustainable parts. They have safety mechanisms to stop small children being killed by the lawnmower. And you expect to see in the showroom maybe the Scandinavian model with the brushed chrome down the side and the rivets that hums as it goes across the lawn. And instead, what you find in the showroom is this. Now, this is actually an ISO standard lawnmower. You see, it has all the right features. It's actually driven by the grass clippings here. There's a speed control. It's got sustainable parts. But it's not quite what you had in mind. And this is the way that us vendors have dealt with standards in the past. We've sold you what we've got in the warehouse on the pretense of it being standard, rather than giving you something that actually sets you free from us. And I'd suggest to you that neither standards nor open source give you the freedom and cost control that you need. I suggest that what you need is the amalgam of the two. What you need is open standards developed in a transparent and inclusive way, that are expressed in a reference implementation, which is released as open source, and which are implemented by multiple vendors in a way that is guaranteed to be compatible. That's what you actually need to give you the freedom to control your costs and to control your future. And that is my goal in open sourcing Java SE. I don't intend that it's going to be something which is a free-for-all. I don't intend that it in any way compromises on the compatibility that you've made your living on. I don't intend that any of the vendors that are involved in the industry are going to be able to take unfair control of the process. Whether those intentions can be executed successfully remains to be seen, but those are the intentions that I and my team and the Java team at Sun have all got in mind as we move towards open sourcing our implementation of Java SE. We've actually done quite a bit of open source. We've, for example, taken the Solaris operating system and made that open source. We've taken... Ooh, that's an interesting effect. Must report some bugs to Patrick when I get home. OpenSolaris is doing pretty well. The numbers on this slide just stay out of date the whole time. There are 30 user groups now, 14,000 members. There's been 100 putbacks, 111 putbacks. Things a year old. OpenOffice.org has now got something like 57 million downloads under its belt, and that's just off our website. The download, it's included with things like Red Hat and with Debian. The number of actual users is absolutely vast. It's got to the point now where governments like the Indian government and the Danish government are standardizing on the file formats that it uses, and it's having a profound effect on the industry. There's OpenSpark. We've open-sourced the chip design that's at the heart of Sun's hardware. And this has made a real difference. It was because we open-sourced the chip designs that the folks that David Miller, working on the Linux kernel, was able to include UltraSpark support in the release of the Linux kernel that came out last weekend. He was able to actually look at the chip designs, know how the chip worked, and therefore build support for the UltraSpark T1 into the Linux kernel. So this, and you know, we've been working on NetBeans, we've been working on a whole range of other things. The experience we have to date with open source and Sun's involvement across the industry with things like Mozilla, where we donated the internationalization framework, and GNOME, where we put in the accessibility framework, all those suggest to me that we can achieve the goals that we intend with Java SE. I believe that it is possible to achieve those goals, to create the guarantee that people need going into the new networked era of freedom and the ability to control costs and control futures within that world of networked software. This is my token Java mention in the presentation, because I thought there ought to be one, because I believe this is a conference about Java. So I threw one in, but there you go. So my mantra in thinking about open source is to say that open source is about collaboration or participation. People align their self-interests casually over what does not differentiate them. And then they use the work of that community to create wealth for themselves. They compete with one another on that commodity base. And the key to success is paradoxically contribution. As you contribute to the technologies, you are able to innovate yourself, but also drive the cycle forward that grows the community and the market and produces more opportunity for profit or success for you within your own parameters. I believe that open source is the powerhouse of the software economy for the coming decades, and I look forward to joining you on the Java SE community or whatever other open source communities are going to bring you happiness, success, and wealth. Thank you very much for listening. What do you think, Kelly? Do you want to do questions? Out of time, oh dear. So I believe that you have breakout sessions now. Or a riot, one or the other. Who votes for the riot? Anyone? Okay. Thank you.